Okay, here we are again with Jeffrey Chen, Andrea, John Robert, and myself, Marco Morelli. We are reading Savitri by Sri Aurobindo. We're on book 7, the book of yoga, canto 5, the finding of the soul. And after a meditation, we will begin with our second reading of this canto.
Canto 5, The Finding of the Soul. Onward she passed, seeking the soul's mystic cave. At first she stepped into a night of God. The light was quenched that helps the laboring world, the power that struggles and stumbles in our life. This inefficient mind gave up its thoughts, the striving heart, its unavailing hopes. All knowledge failed, and the ideas forms, and wisdom screened in awe her lowly head, feeling a truth too great for thought or speech, formless, ineffable, forever the same. And it's an innocent and holy ignorance, adored like one who worships formless God, the unseen light she could not claim nor own. In a simple purity of emptiness, her mind knelt down before the unknowable. All was abolished, save her naked self and the prostrate yearning of her surrendered heart. There was no strength in her, no pride of force. The lofty burning of desire had sunk ashamed, a vanity of separate self. The hope of spiritual greatness fled. Salvation she asked not, nor a heavenly crown. Humility seemed now too proud a state. Herself was nothing, God alone was all. Yet God she knew not, but only knew he was. A sacred darkness brooded now within. The world was a deep darkness, great and nude. This void held more than all the teeming worlds. This blank felt more than all that time has borne. This dark knew dumbly, immensely the unknown, but all was formless, voiceless, infinite.
As might a shadow walk in a shadowy scene, a small knot passing through a mightier knot, a knight of person in a bare outline crossing a fathomless, impersonal night. Silent she moved, empty and absolute. In endless time, her soul reached a wide end. The spaceless vast became her spirit's place. At last, a change approached. The emptiness broke. A wave rippled within. The world had stirred. Once more, her inner self became her space. There was felt a blissful nearness to the goal. Heaven leaned low to kiss the sacred hill. The air trembled with passion and delight. A rose of splendor on a tree of dreams, the face of dawn out of mooned twilight grew. Day came, priest of a sacrifice of joy into the worshiping silence of her world. He carried immortal luster as his robe, trailed heaven like a purple scarf, and wore as his vermilion caste mark a red sun. As if an old remembered dream come true, she recognized in her prophetic mind the imperishable luster of that sky, the tremulous sweetness of that happy air, and covered from mind's view and life's approach, the mystic cavern in the sacred hill, and knew the dwelling of her secret soul. As if in some Elysian cult occult depth, truth's last retreat from thought's profaning touch, as if in a rock temple's solitude hid, God's refuge from an ignorant worshiping world, it lay withdrawn even from life's inner sense, receding from the entangled heart's desire. A marvelous brooding twilight met the eyes, and a holy stillness held that voiceless space.
An awful dimness wrapped the great rock doors, carved in the massive stone of matter's trance. Two golden serpents round the lintel curled, enveloping it with their pure and dreadful strength, looked out with wisdom's deep and luminous eyes. An eagle covered it with wide conquering wings. Flames of self-lost, immobile reverie. Doves crowded the gray musing cornices like sculptured postures of white-bosomed peace. Across the threshold's sleep, she entered in and found herself amid great figures of gods, conscious in stone and living without breath, watching with fixed regard the soul of man, executive figures of the cosmic self, world symbols of immutable potency. On the walls covered with significant shapes, looked at her the life scene of man and beast, and the high meaning of the life of gods, the power and necessity of these numberless worlds, and faces of beings, and stretches of world space spoke the succinct and inexhaustible hieratic message of the climbing planes. In their immensitude, signing infinity, they were the extensions of the self of God, and housed, impassively receiving all his figures and his small and mighty acts, and his passion, and his birth and life and death, and his return to immortality. To the abiding and eternal is their climb, to the pure existence everywhere the same, to the sheer consciousness and the absolute force and the unimaginable and formless bliss, to the mirth in time and the timeless mystery of the triune being who is all and one and yet is no one but himself apart. There was no step of breathing men, no sound, only the living nearness of the soul.
Yet all the worlds and God himself were there. For every symbol was a reality and brought the presence which had given it life. All this she saw and inly felt and knew, not by some thought of mind, but by the self. A light not born of sun or moon or fire, a light that dwelt within and saw within, shedding an intimate visibility, made secrecy more revealing than the word. Our sight and sense are a fallible gaze and touch, and only the spirit's vision is wholly true. As thus she passed in that mysterious place, through room and room, through door and rock-hewn door, she felt herself made one with all she saw. A sealed identity within her woke. She knew herself, the beloved of the supreme. These gods and goddesses were he and she. The mother was she of beauty and delight, the word in Brahma's vast creating clasp, the world puissant on almighty Shiva's lap, the master and the mother of all lives, watching the worlds their twin regard had made, and Krishna and Radha, forever entwined in bliss, the adorer and adored, self-lost and one. In the last chamber, on a golden seat, one sat whose shape no vision could define. Only one felt the world's unattainable fount, a power of which she was a straying force, an invisible beauty, goal of the world's desire, a sun of which all knowledge is a beam, a greatness without whom no life could be. Thence all departed into silent self, and all became formless and pure and bare. Then, through a tunnel dug in the last rock, she came out where there shone a deathless sun. A house was there, all made of flame and light, and crossing a wall of doorless living fire, there suddenly she met her secret soul.
A being stood immortal in transience, deathless, dallying with momentary things, in whose wide eyes of tranquil happiness, which pity and sorrow could not abrogate, infinity turned its gaze on finite shapes. Observer of the silent steps of the hours, eternity upheld the minute's acts and the passing scenes of the everlasting's play. In the mystery of its selecting will, in the divine comedy, a participant, the spirit's conscious representative, God's delegate in our humanity, comrade of the universe, the transcendent ray, she had come into the mortal body's room to play at ball with time and circumstance. A joy in the world, her master movement here, the passion of the game lighted her eyes. A smile on her lips welcomed Earth's bliss and grief. A laugh was her return to pleasure and pain. All things she saw as the masquerade of truth disguised in the costumes of ignorance, crossing the years to immortality. All she could front with the strong spirit's peace. But since she knows the toil of mind and life as a mother feels and shares her children's lives, she puts forth a small portion of herself, a being no bigger than the thumb of man, into a hidden region of the heart to face the pang and to forget the bliss, to share the suffering and endure Earth's wounds and labor mid the labor of the stars.
This in us laughs and weeps, suffers the stroke, exults in victory, struggles for the crown. Identified with the mind and body and life, it takes on itself their anguish and it bleeds with fate's whips and hangs upon the cross. It is the unwounded and immortal self supporting the actor in the human scene. Through this, she sends us her glory and her powers, pushes to wisdom's heights through misery's gulfs. She gives us strength to do our daily task and sympathy that partakes of others' grief and the little strength we have to help our race. We who must fill the role of the universe, acting itself out in a slight human shape and on our shoulders carry the struggling world. This is in us the Godhead, small and marred. In this human portion of divinity, she seats the greatness of the soul in time. To uplift from light to light, from power to power, till on a heavenly peak it stands, a king. In body weak, in its heart an invincible might, it climbs stumbling, held up by an unseen hand, a toiling spirit in a mortal shape. Here in this chamber of flame and light they met. They looked upon each other, knew themselves, the secret deity and its human part, the calm immortal and the struggling soul. Then, with a magic transformation speed, they rushed into each other and grew one. Once more, she was human upon earthly soil, in the muttering night amid the rain-swept woods and the rude cottage where she sat in trance. That subtle world withdrew deeply within, behind the sun veil of the inner sight. But now, the half-opened lotus bud of her heart had bloomed and stood disclosed to the earthly ray, in an image shown revealed her sacred soul.
There was no wall severing the soul and mind, no mystic fence guarding from the claims of life. In its deep lotus home, her being sat as if on concentration's marble seat, calling the mighty mother of the worlds to make this earthly tenement her house. As in a flash from a supernal light, a living image of the original power, a face, a form came down into her heart and made of it its temple and pure abode. But when its feet had touched the quivering bloom, a mighty movement rocked the inner space, as if a world were shaken and found its soul. Out of the unconscious, soulless, mindless night, a flaming serpent rose, released from sleep. It rose, billowing its coils, and stood erect and climbing mightily, stormily on its way. It touched her centers with its flaming mouth. As if a fiery kiss had broken their sleep, they bloomed and laughed, surcharged with light and bliss. Then at the crown, it joined the eternal's space. In the flower of the head, in the flower of matter space, in each divine stronghold and nature knot, it held together the mystic stream which joins the viewless summits with the unseen depths, the string of forts that make the frail defense safeguarding us against the enormous world, our lines of self-expression in its vast. An image sat of the original power, wearing the mighty mother's form and face. Armed, bearer of the weapon and sign, whose occult might no magic can imitate. Manifold yet one, she sat, a guardian force, a savior gesture stretched her lifted arm, a symbol of some native cosmic strength. A sacred beast lay prone below her feet, a silent, flame-eyed mass of living force.
All underwent a high celestial change. Breaking the blackened conscience blind mute wall, effacing the circles of the ignorance, powers and divinities burst flaming forth, each part of the being trembling with delight, lay overwhelmed with tides of happiness, and saw her hand in every circumstance, and felt her touch in every limb and cell. In the country of the lotus of the head, which thinking mind has made its busy space, in the castle of the lotus twixt the brows, whence it shoots the arrows of its sight and will, in the passage of the lotus of the throat, where speech must rise and the expressing mind and the heart's impulse run towards word and act, a glad uplift and a new working came. The immortal's thoughts displaced our bounded view. The immortal's thoughts, earth's drab idea and sense. All things now bore a deeper, heavenlier sense. A glad, clear harmony marked their truth's outline. Reset the balance and measures of the world. Each shape showed its occult design, unveiled God's meaning in it for which it was made, and the vivid splendor of his artist thought. A channel of the mighty mother's choice, the immortal's will took into its calm control our blind or erring government of life. A loose republic once of wants and needs, then bowed to the uncertain sovereign mind. Life now obeyed to a diviner rule, and every act became an act of God. In the kingdom of the lotus of the heart, love chanting its pure hymeneal hymn, made life and body mirrors of sacred joy, and all the emotions gave themselves to God.
In the naval lotus, broad imperial range, its proud ambitions and its master lusts were tamed into instruments of a great calm sway to do a work of God on earthly soil. In the narrow nether center's petty parts, its childish game of daily dwarf desires was changed into a sweet and boisterous play, a romp of little gods with life in time. In the deep place where once the serpent slept, there came a grip on matter's giant powers for large utilities in life's little space. A firm ground was made for heaven's descending might. Behind all reigned her sovereign deathless soul, casting aside its veil of ignorance, allied to gods and cosmic beings and powers. It built the harmony of its human state, surrendered into the great world mother's hands until she obeyed her soul's supreme behest in the enigma of the inconscient world. A secret soul behind, supporting all, its master is master and witness of our ignorant life, admits the person's look and nature's role. But once the hidden doors are flung apart, then the veiled king steps out in nature's front. A light comes down into the ignorance. A heavy, painful knot loosens its grasp. The mind becomes a mastered instrument and life a hue and figure of the soul. All happily grows towards knowledge and towards bliss. A divine puissance then takes nature's place and pushes the movements of our body and mind, possessor of our passionate hopes and dreams, the beloved despot of our thoughts and acts. She streams into us with her unbound force, into mortal limbs, the immortal's rapture and power.
An inner law of beauty shapes our lives. Our words become the natural speech of truth. Each thought is a ripple on a sea of light. Then sin and virtue leave the cosmic lists. They struggle no more in our delivered hearts. Our acts chime with God's simple natural good or serve the rule of a supernal right. All moods unlovely, evil, and untrue forsake their stations in fierce disarray and hide their shame in the subconscious dusk. Then lifts the mind a cry of victory. O soul, my soul, we have created heaven. Within we have found the kingdom here of God, his fortress built in a loud, ignorant world. Our life is entrenched between two rivers of light. We have turned space into a gulf of peace and made the body a capital of bliss. What more, if more must still be done? In the slow process of the evolving spirit, in the brief stage between a death and birth, the first perfection stage is reached at last. Out of the wood and stone of our nature stuff, a temple is shaped where the high gods could live. Even if the struggling world is left outside, one man's perfection still can save the world. There is one a new proximity to the skies, a first betrothal of the earth to heaven, a deep concordat between truth and life. A camp of God is pitched in human time. End of Canto 5.
Any thoughts or reflections?
And notice the irony of the mind's cry of victory on the last page. What more? What more if more must still be done?
It would be a nice place to stay for a while. I had forgotten this canto. You know, we read it in like two, three weeks ago. And then my mind was on other things up until the moment that we were going to get started. So it's shorter than I remember it, one. But two, I think to your observation, John Robert, there is really a consummation here, right? This is the absolute and the particular coming together. And there's the Kundalini thing. There's a few stages to what happens, but where we land, where this canto brings us is to that union. It's to the union between the individual, the relative self, the priorly presumed to be separate, perhaps presumed to be separate self, and then God. I have trouble saying the word God. I just say it doesn't sound right coming out of my mouth.
Andrea and I have been having a discussion about that last few times.
We have the same problem at times.
Okay.
It's a loaded word. It's such a loaded word.
I prefer that with a capital T infinitely to God.
Yeah, I'm glad he, Aurobindo, can use it fluidly and easily in a way without any, not too much conflict, sense of discomfort, because otherwise that's a complex, I guess, topic about why we have baggage and why it's difficult for us. But in some ways, it's almost too. I like the Hebrew tradition of not saying the name of God and of like reserving a sort of sacredness to it, you know, by not uttering it. I think there's something to that. That is more accurate. Like it's like we can't say the word without in some way falsifying it or what God is. But in this canto, it's a canto, I think, about God realization, right? It's about what traditionally in the yogic path would be called God realization. So I understand why it's here. And this idea that the self becomes a temple or becomes a home for the divine, I think is really important. And that sense of that this in the last page, a first perfection's stage is reached at last. That line jumped out at me because, well, it's not the last, it's the first of presumably other perfections. But this one is, it's like really an important one. Like you could, that also the image of a camp of God, like I see a world and maybe these little points of light or these little places where an awakening happens. But a camp is a very vulnerable kind of thing, right? It's just not even a foothold. It's just like a toe, and I know that where this is going or where what we've been through before, that we're working on there's a larger project going on here too. Like we don't just want, or Sri Aurobindo wasn't just describing a camp, but a larger, a whole, sometimes talks about empire, sometimes talks about other, larger forms. And so this is just a beginning, right, of another larger cycle or stage. I don't know.
I know for this God thing, so I kind of cheat in my book because I hide behind the main character who is part of a religious community in which God is a perfectly normal word to say. So I hide my own difficulties behind the character who does not have the same difficulties.
That's the uses of fiction, for mm-hmm. sure.
This is one of those cantos that sounds scriptural to me. And different in its own way. There's more of an intimacy about it than mm-hmm. some of his other ones, but it just seems like every word is precious in this canto.
Yeah, on the first page, there's this one section I would actually love to read it again. Her mind knelt down before the unknowable. All was abolished save her naked self and the prostrate yearning of her surrendered heart. There was no strength in her, no pride of force. The lofty burning of desire had sunk ashamed, a vanity of separate self. The hope of spiritual greatness fled. Salvation she asked not, nor a heavenly crown. Humility seemed now too proud a state. Herself was nothing, God alone was all. Yet God she knew not, but only knew he was. Sublime. That line, yet God she knew not, but only knew he was, that feels so right. Certainly in my experience. By the way, the other word that I really love to indicate that is the divine. The mother uses the divine a lot. When she speaks of God, she talks of the divine. And the way she says the word, it's like there's such sweetness in it, such tenderness in how she says the divine. You can feel that. It's really beautiful. So that's my preferred word if I am beyond that. If I get more personal than that.
My preferred word is the numinous. That's the word I find least, the most accessible.
Yeah. It's very neutral.
Yeah, but it has a kind of luminosity that I associate it with. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's one thing I like about the Indian tradition is that there are many, many names. That one could use. And also I think that's part of what allows poetry to be creative, is that like no one name is finally the right word, right? That a poem can find creative ways of signifying that without using a particular word that is supposed to represent that. Because part of it is in this like negative capability that, you know, John Keats talked about, but it's also here in this poem, in that sacred darkness, which is that very the next line from the one you read, Andrea, sacred darkness brooded now within. The world was a deep darkness, great and nude. The void held more than all the teeming worlds. This blank felt more than all that time has borne. This dark knew dumbly, immensely, the unknown. Like there's always this play between darkness and light, and between the ignorance and knowing, and between the relative self and the absolute. And I think that sometimes the best way that we can signify the absolute or the all or the numinous or the divine is to not signify, to allow a space for it to reveal itself, like for it to make its presence known and felt beyond our words or beyond language. And I thought too that another line that jumped out at me this time in particular, more so, is that it's not a one-way street. It's not just the self recognizing the divine, but like on 527, toward the end of that section, when this union happens, Aurobindo writes that of the self and the divine, that they looked upon each other, knew themselves, the secret deity and its human part, the calm immortal and the struggling soul, which echoes those first lines, that first page, where and we get the image of Savitri as almost completely emptied of any pretensions or any aspirate, like there's nothing left. It's almost like a rock bottom. Like there's nothing else she can do. Like she's, and then there's the mutual recognition. So it's not just that she's seeing, or she's also being seen by, and that the divine is recognizing him, her, it, themselves in the human, in that destitute being, right? That being that is, you know, just the struggling aspect. I think that's almost in a way more powerful, that the divine sees themselves in us, not than we see the divine in ourselves. Like in a way that I think decenters us in a way that is more authentic.
That was actually the astonishing experience I had when Mother and I looked at each other. It was exactly that. They looked upon each other, knew themselves. There was first just an immense silence with nothing, which is kind of what this describes too. And all of a sudden, we recognized each other. There was no difference. And so, you know, then I walk away from that, you know, and tears just start running down my face, because not only, I mean, it was like I recognized myself, right? My soul. That's what happens, is all my veils were torn in that moment. And it was soul to soul, and there was no difference. It was just could have never imagined having such an experience. I had no idea that was possible. But this is right here. The calm immortal and the struggling soul. Yeah.
What about that next line? With the magic transformation speed, they rushed into each other and grew one.
But for me, that was internal inside of me. I wouldn't say that I had that, but I would not. I don't know. I can't.
That doesn't describe your experience exactly.
No, the experience is the look upon each other and knew ourselves, knew each other, knew themselves, right? Each other, themselves, the secret deity and its human part. And they were the same.
When I was young, I used to stare into the mirror. And I would just try to get past that sense of separateness from my reflection.
Yeah.
Try to perceive into what's really happening there in that dynamic between right. self and reflection. I just remember that. I mean, this is like an adolescent in my bedroom staring into the mirror, yeah. like, you know, just confronting the fact of yeah. my existence and whether I could kind of get on the other side of the sense of self or something. It's hard to describe what that was about, but it comes to mind when you describe yeah. your encounter with the mother.
Yeah, it's like getting to know yourself, right? Your deeper self.
Mm-hmm.
You look in the mirror. It's a powerful thing to do, to look in the mirror, to really look into your eyes, your own eyes. You get that. It creates a loop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like the other, the figure of the mother becomes the mirror for you mm-hmm. or for her. And like you...
Yeah, and it was the same. Yeah, there was that line that I came across recently. Two mirrors facing into infinity. I don't know where I caught that, but...
I wanted to come back to this idea of the different names for God or that, or whatever. So I have a partial... It's one of the things I appreciate about Islam. The list of names of God. So I have a partial list of the 99 names of God in Islam. So Al-Rahman, the All-Compassionate, Al-Rahim, the Most Merciful, Al-Malik, the One and Only, Al-Aldus, the All-Pure, As-Salam, the Giver of Peace, Al-Muhaymin, the Absolute Master, Al-Mumin, the Supreme Believer, Al-Aziz, the Exalted, Al-Jabbar, the Supreme Power, and so on and so on. And so when they say, you know, what's the term they use? Well, Inshallah, but also sacred the name of Allah, and then they name the different names, but not all of them. They each... You know, they'll pick the particular name that goes with the context. And so there's always a blessing in relation to the particular characteristic of Allah that they're referring to through the names. It's very interesting.
Maybe it's kind of like the idea of Eskimos having many names for snow. Is right, but really, I mean, it's part of like a kind of cultural richness that one develops through in-depth personal experience, right? And through having access or having experience with different aspects of a totality that's ineffable. Like, there's no one aspect that exhausts it.
Yeah.
And also like a culture that reflects, dwells on those aspects, will come up with a lot more language to yeah. talk about it and to commute, you know, to share, you know, to share it, you know, socially.
Yeah, Hinduism has the same thing. They have like the thousand names of God. And it actually means it's infinite, you know, because you can always add. Yeah.
So how are you feeling about where we're at in the reading? It's just not even an hour, about an hour. We could read it again. We could go on to the next canto. I feel a little, I still have some energy. I wanted to continue for a little while, do something.
I could. I feel very complete with what we just had. It might be interesting to read it again since it's so short, rather than delving into a whole other canto.
I could read it again myself. I mean, it would take us about maybe 30 minutes or less. And then we can maybe try to give it our best, do a complete reading, and then just close right there.
Yeah, I think that suits me.
Okay.
I'm not keen to get into another thing and then leave it open-ended because I'm not sure I'll be able to make the next time and so forth.
Oh, that's right. You'll be traveling.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll do a first reading of Canto 6 next time. And then I imagine you may be able to join us the subsequent time to do the second reading. Why don't we change the order then?
So I just finished reading. I think maybe John Robert could start. Then
me, then Jeffrey Jen, then you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Canto 5, The Finding of the Soul. Onward she passed, seeking the soul's mystic cave. At first she stepped into a night of God. The light was quenched that helps the laboring world, the power that struggles and stumbles in our life. This inefficient mind gave up its thoughts, the striving heart its unavailing hopes. All knowledge failed, and the ideas forms, and wisdom screened in awe her lowly head, feeling a truth too great for thought or speech, formless, ineffable, forever the same. An innocent and holy ignorance, adored like one who worships formless God, the unseen light she could not claim nor own. In a simple purity of emptiness, her mind knelt down before the unknowable. All was abolished save her naked self and the prostrate yearning of her surrendered heart. There was no strength in her, no pride of force. The lofty burning of desire had sunk ashamed, a vanity of separate self. The hope of spiritual greatness fled. Salvation she asked not, nor a heavenly crown. Humility seemed now too proud a state. Herself was nothing. God alone was all. Yet God she knew not, but only knew he was. A sacred darkness brooded now within. The world was a deep darkness, great and nude. This void held more than all the teeming worlds. This blank felt more than all that time has borne. This dark knew dumbly, immensely, the unknown. But all was formless, voiceless, infinite.
As might a shadow walk in a shadowy scene, a small knot passing through a mightier knot, a knight of person in a bare outline, crossing a fathomless impersonal night, silent she moved, empty and absolute. In endless time, her soul reached a wide end. The spaceless vast became her spirit's place. At last, a change approached. The emptiness broke. A wave rippled within. The world had stirred. Once more, her inner self became her space. There was felt a blissful nearness to the goal. Heaven leaned low to kiss the sacred hill. The air trembled with passion and delight. A rose of splendor on a tree of dreams, the face of dawn out of moon to twilight grew. Day came, priest of a sacrifice of joy, into the worshiping silence of her world. He carried immortal luster as his robe, trailed heaven like a purple scarf, and wore as his vermilion cast mark a red sun. As if an old remembered dream come true, she recognized in her prophetic mind the imperishable luster of that sky, the tremulous sweetness of that happy air, and, covered from mind's view and life's approach, the mystic cavern in the sacred hill, and knew the dwelling of her secret soul. As if in some Elysian occult depth, truth's last retreat from thought's profaning touch, as if in a rock temple's solitude hid, God's refuge from an ignorant, worshiping world, it lay withdrawn even from life's inner sense, receding from the entangled heart's desire. A marvelous brooding twilight met the eyes, and a holy stillness held that voiceless space.
An awful dimness wrapped the great rock doors carved in the massive stone of matter's trance. Two golden serpents round the lintel curled, enveloping it with their pure and dreadful strength, looked out with wisdom's deep and luminous eyes. An eagle covered it with wide conquering wings, flames of self-lost, immobile reverie. Doves crowded the gray musing cornices like sculptured postures of white-bosomed peace. Across the threshold sleep, she entered in and found herself amid great figures of gods conscious in stone and living without breath, watching with fixed regard the soul of man, executive figures of the cosmic self, world symbols of immutable potency. On the walls covered with significant shapes, looked at her the life scene of man and beast and the high meaning of the life of gods, the power and necessity of those numberless worlds, the faces of beings and stretches of world space spoke the succinct and inexhaustible hieratic message of the climbing planes. In their immensitude, signing infinity, they were the extension of the self of God, and housed, impassively receiving all, his figures and his small and mighty acts, and his passion and his birth and life and death and his return to immortality. To the abiding and eternal is their climb, to the pure existence everywhere the same, to the sheer consciousness and the absolute force, and the unimaginable and formless bliss, to the mirth in time and the timeless mystery of the triune being who is all and one, and yet is no one but himself apart. There was no step of breathing men, no sound only the living nearness of the soul.
Yet all the worlds and God himself were there, for every symbol was a reality and brought the presence which had given it life. All this she saw and inly felt and knew, not by some thought of mind, but by the self. A light not born of sun or moon or fire, a light that dwelt within and saw within, shedding an intimate visibility, made secrecy more revealing than the word. Our sight and sense are a fallible gaze and touch, and only spirit's vision is wholly true. As thus she passed in that mysterious place, through room and room, through door and rock-hewn door, she felt herself made one with all she saw. A sealed identity within her woke. She knew herself the beloved of the Supreme. These gods and goddesses were he and she. The mother was she of beauty and delight. The word in Brahma's vast creating clasp, the world puissance on almighty Shiva's lap. The master and the mother of all lives, watching the worlds their twin regard had made. And Krishna and Radha, forever entwined in bliss, the adorer and adored, self-lost and one. In the last chamber, on a golden seat, one sat, whose shape no vision could define. Only one felt the world's unattainable fount, a power of which she was a straying force, an invisible beauty, goal of the world's desire, a sun of which all knowledge is a beam, a greatness without whom no life could be. Thence all departed into silent self, and all became formless and pure and bare. Then through a tunnel dug in the last rock, she came out where there shone a deathless sun.
A house was there, all made of flame and light. And crossing a wall of doorless living fire, there suddenly she met her secret soul. A being stood immortal in transience, deathless, dallying with momentary things, in whose wide eyes of tranquil happiness, which pity and sorrow could not abrogate, infinity turned its gaze on finite shapes. Observer of the silent steps of the hours, eternity upheld the minute's acts and the passing scenes of the everlasting's play. In the mystery of its selecting will, in the divine comedy, a participant, the spirit's conscious representative, God's delegate in our humanity, comrade of the universe, the transcendence ray. She had come into the mortal body's room to play at ball with time and circumstance. A joy in the world, her master movement here. The passion of the game lighted her eyes. A smile on her lips welcomed Earth's bliss and grief. A laugh was her return to pleasure and pain. All things she saw as a masquerade of truth disguised in the costumes of ignorance, crossing the years to immortality. All she could front with the strong spirit's peace. But since she knows the toil of mind and life, as a mother feels and shares her children's lives. She puts forth a small portion of herself, a being no bigger than the thumb of man, into a hidden region of the heart to face the pang and to forget the bliss, to share the suffering and endure Earth's wounds and labor in the labor of the stars.
This in us laughs and weeps, suffers the stroke, exults in victory, struggles for the crown. Identified with the mind and body and life, it takes on itself their anguish and defeat, bleeds with fate's whips and hangs upon the cross, yet is the unwounded and immortal self supporting the actor in the human scene. Through this, she sends us her glory and her powers, pushes to wisdom's heights through misery's gulfs. She gives us strength to do our daily task and sympathy that partakes of others' grief. And the little strength we have to help our race, we who must fill the role of the universe, acting itself out in a slight human shape, and on our shoulders carry the struggling world. This is in us, the Godhead, small and marred. In this human portion of divinity, she seats the greatness of the soul in time, to uplift from light to light, from power to power, till on the heavenly peak it stands, a king. In body weak, in its heart an invincible might, it climbs stumbling, held up by an unseen hand, a toiling spirit in a mortal shape. Here in this chamber of flame and light they met. They looked upon each other, knew themselves, the secret deity and its human part, the calm immortal and the struggling soul. Then with a magic transformation speed, they rushed into each other and grew one. Once more she was human upon earthly soil. In the muttering night amid the rain-swept woods and the rude cottage where she sat in trance, that subtle world withdrew deeply within, behind the sun veil of the inner sight. But now the half-opened lotus bud of her heart had bloomed and stood disclosed to the earthly ray. In an image shown, revealed her secret soul.
There was no wall severing the soul and mind, no mystic fence guarding the claims of life. In its deep lotus home, her being sat as if on concentration's marble seat, calling the mighty mother of the worlds to make this earthly tenement her house. As in a flash from a supernal light, a living image of the original power, a face, a form came down into her heart and made of it its temple and pure abode. But when its feet had touched the quivering bloom, a mighty movement rocked the inner space as if a world were shaken and found its soul. Out of the inconscient, soulless, mindless night, a flaming serpent rose, released from sleep. It rose, billowing its coils, and stood erect and climbing mightily, stormily on its way. It touched her centers with its flaming mouth, as if a fiery kiss had broken their sleep. They bloomed and laughed, surcharged with light and bliss. Then at the crown, it joined the eternal space. In the flower of the head, in the flower of matter's base, in each divine stronghold and nature knot, it held together the mystic stream which joins the viewless summits with the unseen depths. the string of forts that make the frail defense, safeguarding us against the enormous world, our lines of self-expression in its vast. An image sat of the original power, wearing the mighty mother's form and face, armed, bearer of the weapon and the sign whose occult might no magic can imitate. Manifold yet one, she sat, a guardian force, a savior gesture, stretched her lifted arm, and symbol of some native cosmic strength, a sacred beast lay prone below her feet, a silent, flame-eyed mass of living force.
All underwent high celestial change, breaking the black, inconscience, blind, mute wall, effacing the circles of the ignorance, powers and divinities burst flaming forth. Each part of the being, trembling with delight, lay overwhelmed with tides of happiness and saw her hand in every circumstance and felt her touch in every limb and cell. In the country of the lotus of the head, which thinking mind has made its busy space, in the castle of the lotus twixt the brows, whence it shoots the arrows of its sight and will, in the passage of the lotus of the throat, where speech must rise, and the expressing mind, and the heart's impulse run towards word and act, a glad uplift and a new working came. The immortal's thoughts displaced our bounded view, the immortal's thoughts, earth's drab idea and sense. All things now bore a deeper, heavenlier sense. A glad, clear harmony marked their truth's outline, reset the balance and measures of the world. Each shape showed its occult design, unveiled God's meaning in it for which it was made, and the vivid splendor of his artist thought. A channel of the mighty mother's choice, the immortal's will took into its calm control our blind or erring government of life. A loose republic once of wants and needs, then bowed to the uncertain sovereign mind, life now obeyed to a diviner rule, and every act became an act of God. In the kingdom of the lotus of the heart, love chanting its pure hymeneal hymn, made life and body mirrors of sacred joy, and all the emotions gave themselves to God.
In the naval lotus's broad imperial range, its proud ambitions and its master lust were tamed into instruments of a great calm sway to do a work of God on earthly soil. In the narrow nether center's petty parts, its childish game of daily dwarf desires was changed into a sweet and boisterous play, a romp of little gods with life in time. In the deep place where once the serpent slept, there came a grip on matter's giant powers for large utilities in life's little space. A firm ground was made for heaven's descending might. Behind all reigned her sovereign, deathless soul. Casting aside its veil of ignorance, allied to gods and cosmic beings and powers, it built the harmony of its human state. Surrendered into the great world mother's hands, only she obeyed her soul supreme behest in the enigma of the unconscious world. A secret soul behind supporting all is master and witness of our ignorant life. emits the person's look and nature's role. But once the hidden doors are flung apart, then the veiled king steps out in nature's front. A light comes down into the ignorance. Its heavy, painful knot loosens its grip. The mind becomes a mastered instrument, and life a hue and figure of the soul. All happily grows towards knowledge and towards bliss. A divine puissance then takes nature's place and pushes the movements of our body and mind. Possessor of our passionate hopes and dreams, the beloved despot of our thoughts and acts, she streams into us with her unbound force, into mortal limbs, the immortal's rapture and power.
An inner law of beauty shapes our lives. Our words become the natural speech of truth. Each thought is a ripple on a sea of light. Then sin and virtue leave the cosmic lists. They struggle no more in our delivered hearts. Our acts chime with God's simple, natural good, or serve the rule of a supernal right. All moods unlovely, evil and untrue, forsake their stations in fierce disarray, and hide their shame in the subconscious dusk. Then lifts the mind a cry of victory. O soul, my soul, we have created heaven. Within we have found the kingdom here of God, his fortress built in a loud, ignorant world. Our life is entrenched between two rivers of light. We have turned space into a gulf of peace and made the body a capital of bliss. What more? What more? If more must still be done. In the slow process of the evolving spirit, in the brief stage between a death and birth, a first perfection's stage is reached at last. Out of the wood and stone of our nature stuff, a temple is shaped where the high gods could live. Even if the struggling world is left outside, one man's perfection still can save the world. There is one, a new proximity to the skies, a first betrothal of the earth to heaven, a deep concordat between truth and life. A camp of God is pitched in human time. End of Canto 5.
Thank you. That'll send me on my way.
Safe travels.
Yeah, so good to be with each other. God, it's the best.
All right, thank you.
Safe travels and happy travels too, Jeffrey Chen.
Yeah.
Bon voyage.
Bye-bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.
Bye.